Hello and welcome to Cooper Talks, and in this episode I'm going to be having a little look at the development of what are known as the three core ideologies, liberalism, conservatism and socialism. Now, you might be listening to this just out of general interest, in which case, welcome and thank you very much. However, you might be listening more with a view to studying A-level politics, particularly the EdXL route. If you are, then the point of this talk is really just to give you some overall understanding about how the different ideologies have developed and showing the links between them and how they came in reaction to other things. Although I'll mention some of the core thinkers as we go through this, it's not really designed to be an in-depth exploration of each individual ideology nor the specific core thinkers. And it's worth bearing in mind, you won't get examined specifically on this. However, in understanding their developments and their roles, it should give you a bit of an understanding about how the ideologies developed and the context in which they were forged, which will help you better understand and therefore be better able to explain how the ideologies work and how unified and divided the various movements are. So the thing to start with ideologies is really to think about who governs and why do they govern. And this is really where we start with the development of the political philosophy and political ideology. Now, if we went back in time, which we will do here mystically, we can go back to the Roman Empire and particularly to the Christianization of Europe as a whole. So we're going from about 43 CE or AD in old money to about the 7th century, to around 600 plus. And at that time, rule and who ruled was determined by might or by strength. So you would win by conquest, and you basically would hold your power as long as you were able to subdue your rivals or those beneath you. Might was right, so to speak. So kings, occasionally queens, warlords, chieftains, emperors, tended to dominate because they had the biggest army, they were the best, most organised warlord or leader, whatever it might be. Control and authority came through armies and fear. And so the rule of law or political rule and government was based on strength. However, as Europe began to become increasingly Christianised from the 7th century up to the 16th century, and as Christian religion came to dominate all aspects of society, there became a link between Christian morality, Christian dogma, and government and the authority to govern. Now, Christianity very much promoted the idea of obedience. So this is the medieval Catholic teaching, not saying that's how it is now, but it's very much the idea of obedience and submitting to the will of God and those above you. And this sees the development of the idea of monarchy, coming from the words mono, meaning one, and arch, or arch, meaning chief, leader, or ruler. So an archbishop is a lead bishop, someone who's superior to others. So we end up with the monarch, someone who ruled by divine right, one person bestowed with authority from God. So this divine right of rule was coming in thanks to Christian teachings, and it very much practiced the idea of Christian obedience, that everybody should obey their king because their king, occasionally queen, was chosen by God. So this is the idea. Monarchs are anointed and chosen by God, therefore whatever they say, whatever they do, they represent God's will, and they must be obeyed. Now, this also gives a huge amount of authority to the church, mainly in the form of the Pope. And the Pope was able to legitimize a monarch, most notably in the Holy Roman Empire, when it was up to the Pope to crown an emperor, first one being Charlemagne in 800 AD or CE. But also people like William the Conqueror, although he conquered England in 1066 as a result of might, he did it with papal authority. Pope Gregory the VII gave him authority and legitimacy for conducting the campaign and becoming king. So it gives the church a huge amount of power, and it therefore means people had to obey the king if they were given the backing of the church. Now, the question that arose was, how does God choose? Now, in terms of things like the Battle of Hastings, say, or any other military conquest, you could argue that it was God siding with the victors. And so it wasn't necessarily they won through might, it was that they won because of God's will. But what about kings who didn't achieve battle through God's grace? Well, the argument was it came through the hereditary principle of primogeniture, that the firstborn son would inherit the title, and that God chose the son to be the future monarch. So it was God's will. And if you tried to get around that for whatever reason, you were subverting God's will, and treason was not only a political punishment or a political crime, it was also an affront to God. So, in this period, 7th century to the 16th century, pretty much everyone accepts the divine right of a king, occasionally a queen, but not often, to rule however they want without question, because they only have to answer to God, and any mistakes they make will be between them and God. It would not be for mortals to question the actions of the monarch. So whether the monarch was doing a good job or not, it just had to be accepted and obeyed. If they got it wrong, they answered to God in the future, after they died. And this meant monarchy is really family affairs, and they get to rule with absolute power, and only God can judge them. So effectively on earth, they can do what they want. Now, there are some limitations that come through, like Magna Carta. But even then, the authority and the divine rights of kings becomes part of the sacred document and part of all ideology at the time. So during the medieval era, God chose the monarchs, and that was it. There was no role for people. Now, what do we get coming along in the 16th century? We get the Reformation. The Reformation will build on Renaissance thinking as well, and the Scientific Revolution will come along, and eventually we get to the Age of Enlightenment. So between 1500 and 1800, things start to get shaken up. The Reformation ends up challenging the power of the Catholic Church and its authority and justification for choosing monarchs and emperors, arguing that actually, instead of the church choosing church leaders, it should be up to small local communities to choose their own spiritual leaders, their own priests, and be able to remove them, should they so wish. And what starts to emerge in the Reformation along religious grounds will start to transform into political theory as well. If you can choose your own preachers, then maybe you can choose your own leaders, and then it's a short jump to choosing your own monarchs. So the idea started to develop of rulers being chosen by their peers rather than by God. And this starts to take off. And it ties in with part of the Renaissance, the discovery of ancient texts linked to democracy, and particularly the way some city-states were ruled by guilds and other institutions, where they chose their leader, and the leader had to answer to the people, not to God. The scientific discoveries that came along about the nature of the Earth and so on, Galileo and the Earth going around the Sun rather than the other way around, also the development of autopsies and of lightning, all these sorts of things, starts to challenge the authority of the Church. The Church has been saying, this is how the world works, it's all down to God's will. People are now questioning that and saying, well, hang on, turns out that doesn't fit with this science that's coming through. And maybe we can apply scientific theory to politics as well as church governance and make something that works better for man rather than just saying it all comes down to God's will. So people start to question those in authority, not just in the church but in politics as well, and they stop obediently doing what they are told. Now, this isn't everyone by any means. We're talking mainly about philosophers and key thinkers and leading nobles, middle classes, as we might call them now. But they start questioning things and saying, hang on, why are we tolerating this? Is this God's will? Is there a better way of doing this? So people are asking, why should I do what this person wants me to do? And that's going to see two really crucial events, and the creation, the development of the idea of liberalism in the 17th and 18th centuries. Now, in the 17th century, there was the English Civil War. And this was based, obviously, on religious doctrine, But while the king was trying to assert, King Charles I of England was trying to assert his divine right to rule, that he only answered to God and didn't have to answer to Parliament, parliamentarians, defending the Reformation from an increasingly pro-Catholic monarch, started saying, well, hang on, no, you don't. You don't represent God's will. In fact, as far as we're concerned, you're subverting God's will. And they then, eventually, this will lead to a civil war in England, and the radical step where Parliament will choose to remove the monarch, to have the king executed, to say, no, you haven't done a good enough job, therefore we're getting rid of you. We're not going to leave it to answer to God. You're going to answer to us for your crimes. And this really starts to shape what will become liberalism. The idea comes through that government governs with the consent of the governed. That Charles I's failures was that he tried to govern alone and did not have the support of the people he governed. And this leads to the idea that kings could rule, as in Charles I's case, but only because the people allowed them to rule. Therefore, it wasn't divine, it wasn't God's gift, but really the people giving them permission to rule over them. If it's the people who allow monarchs to rule over them, then the theory goes, the next jump, the people can remove a monarch who is not doing a good job. And this leads to the idea of a social contract, that the government has powers to make laws, to collect taxes, to punish people, enforce laws, declare war, and so on. But they also have responsibilities to ensure the state is well run, that the rule of law is applied, and that people are free to get on with their own lives. So it's a deal. You get the power, but you also have responsibilities. And that it's a contract between the government in power and the governed over who they rule. And these ideas start to germinate and people start thinking about them. People like Thomas Hobbes, John Locke, Mary Wollstonecraft will come along and they'll start looking at them and saying, well, what does all this mean? We've put our trust in the Bible, in God, in religious studies for centuries. And now we're saying it's not God, but it's man who can come up with these things. So what does this mean? How do we apply these laws? And it led to the development of an idea in something called natural laws and natural rights. Now, no one knows exactly where these come from. There was lots of debate about what they were. But it was the idea that before Christianity, before society existed, there were these natural laws that inherently humans just followed. And so they would do things in the common good. And that these were natural laws that had maybe been subverted by Christian teachings or by corrupt monarchies over years and to the detriment of humankind. These natural laws are based really on a positive view of humanity, that human beings are just naturally good, and they will naturally do things that will benefit themselves. There is a selfishness here, but also that will benefit others. So the idea is you be in a small community and you might want food. So you'll go out to get the food because that's a natural law. You want to eat. Someone else might have the food, but you won't just go and take it from them. You might look to maybe do a trade with them because that would be in your best interest. Starting a war could be detrimental to your own self-interest. But equally, someone else wouldn't want a neighbour starving because that could bring disease, that could bring social unrest and social conflict. So just naturally, people would want to share their food products with other people for the greater good, the greater harmony. Now, you don't have to believe that, but those were the natural laws and the sort of positive view of humanity that people had, that people are naturally good and naturally want to improve and be better. This will lead to the idea of the social contract, that people want to just get on and do their own thing. And while there may be a need for a government for overall protection, that it answers to the people and it listens to the people and does what's in the best interest of those people. It also leads to the idea that by following natural rights, although government might be necessary for overall defence and things like that, basically people should be free individually. They should be free from government control. Too many laws, too many restrictions, they're what cause all the problems. And actually, if you just let people be free to do their own things, to live where they want to live, to be whatever they want to be, rather than telling them, you must be a peasant, you must be a serf, you must be this type of apprentice, then it will lead to a greater happiness for everyone. And they really do promote the primacy of the individual, that it's all up to your individual talents and individual abilities. So a key idea of liberalism is meritocracy. And they say this allows social mobility, that you can go from being, you know, at the bottom of the rung. If you are motivated enough, you will go all the way up. You can reach the top levels of society, but you can also go backwards. You can go down the ranks. They see, for many of the early liberals, social mobility is mostly through education. So they believe having access to education, learning new skills, learning new ideas, that will help you to develop your skills, to become richer or wealthier, to move to bigger places, and to move up to the middle classes, maybe even to buy positions in the nobility, and to become much higher in your social standing. Not only do they see education as key to this, but they see the laws and restrictions of the church that said, this is your place, just accept it. They saw old hereditary positions or social restrictions on class, rules about movement where peasants or serfs weren't allowed to leave their local village to move to where they wanted to. They saw these as obstacles to social mobility, so they wanted to remove these laws to allow individuals to follow their own path. Tied very closely with all these positive views and this idea of social freedom was the idea of laissez-faire or free market economics, that taxes and trade restrictions, that monopolies, these were all bad ideas, and that actually people should just be free to buy and sell goods, that the markets should be free and they will naturally fall in line with what the people want and what the people need. People will be able to exploit an opportunity to generate money for themselves. It provides an incentive for social advancement. You want the bigger house, you want the bigger car, you want something better for your children, and you will trade. And if your trades don't work, well, bad news for you. People will learn from that and they'll go on and do something else that will work. So free market economics is actually an incredibly liberal idea, that there shouldn't be any restrictions on trade or policy development or anything like that. So these ideas of liberalism start to emerge largely in reaction to the English Civil War. And although he's classed as a conservative thinker, and he has quite a pessimistic view of humanity, Thomas Hobbes comes through with some sort of liberal ideas. John Locke, the big one, again, writing in the wake of the English Civil War, which has thrown everything up in the air, changed everyone's ideas about how society works and society should be structured. These early thinkers are trying to make sense of this new world, trying to think about, well, what justifies parliamentary sovereignty? This will go on to form the Bill of Rights, which Locke was heavily involved with during the Glorious Revolution of 1688. How can the power of the monarch be restricted? What ensures freedom of individual citizens from overpowerful government? And the whole concept of a rule of law, that instead of being a society that's obedient and just blindly follows what they are told through religious teachings, there should be principles of the rule of law, that we are a society based on laws and that everyone is subject equally to these laws to provide for the greatest sum of human happiness. So these ideas come through in England, and they're developed, and thinkers will take them on, like I said, like with John Locke, Mary Wollstonecraft, Rousseau, they will take these ideas on. And eventually, through the Enlightenment, they will reach their pinnacle. Now, probably the pinnacle is the creation of the USA. They use the thinkings and the writings of people like John Locke and liberal ideology to justify the rejection of monarchy. In the Declaration of Independence, Thomas Jefferson clearly says, when a monarch has failed, it's the duty of the people to dissolve those ties of fealty and to basically create a new system of government that will work better. They justify the rejection of royal control of George III because he's done a bad job. He has failed as a leader. Therefore, using liberal ideology, that it's up to them to find a better system of government. And this leads to the creation of a constitutional democracy. Again, the constitution is designed very much to limit the power of the government, to have a system of separation of powers and checks and balances so that the government has authority to do what's needed and to keep the people safe, but it has very little in the way of powers to become dictatorial or tyrannical, and that it has to answer to the people in the form of regular democratic elections at all levels. And there are certain inalienable rights that the government cannot restrict on the people, and this will be formulated in the Bill of Rights. And we might say now, oh, the Second Amendment, how's that freedom for people? The idea was, if a government becomes overmighty and sends in the troops to try and suppress the people, the people should have the right to arm themselves and defy the government. And the government shouldn't have the power to remove their weapons or their means of defending themselves from such a powerful government. So it does make absolute sense in the context of the time. And again, it's a society based on the rules of laws with a clear judiciary that will help to enforce them. And in America, it seems to work. Now, arguably, that's because America is far away from everyone else. But it seemed to work. And OK, there were hiccups on the way, but the American Constitution sets up a liberal form of democracy, of separation of powers, limited government and individual rights and freedoms in a capitalist free market utopia, they would say. This then inspired the next revolution, another liberal revolution at the start, the French Revolution. Again, the Louis XVI had failed as a monarch, and that leads to an uprising in 1789 and the rejection, certainly of the absolute Bourbon monarchy. This will eventually descend into terror, but they're modelling it on the USA. It's meant to be about the creation of a constitutional democracy with a Bill of Rights, a society based on the rule of law. And to link in with nationalism, the idea that the monarch would become not the king of France, king of the land, but king of the French. They would rule a people and be answerable to those people, not that they ruled the land and the people on the land answered to the monarch. It was a subtle but really important distinction. And the French Revolution, certainly up until 1793, looked to be creating a liberal utopia along the lines of France. However, in France, things go drastically wrong, mainly when the monarch refuses to accept these constitutional limitations. And it leads to the terror, a huge amount of violence with thousands and a significant chunk. I think it was about 5% or 20%. I can't remember off the top of my head. Anyway, a large percentage of the French population being executed with the guillotine, and basically mob rule and anarchy erupting in Paris and elsewhere in France. And this leads to a conservative reaction. People like Edmund Burke, who supported the French Revolution, mainly because it was weakening the French, but said, hey, this is great. The French have finally got on board. They finally realised that, you know, absolute monarchy is not the way to go. They're becoming cultured like the English. But then he looks at the descent into violence, the mob rule that emerges amongst the uneducated sans-culottes and the violence and destruction. And they say, well, this is the problem. You give the power to the people, the people can't be trusted to govern themselves. They don't know what to do with it. They will become violent and they'll be selfish. And so this leads to the birth, really, of the conservative ideology. People like Burke see in France the mob take control and they say, this is wrong. This is the problem with the people. They're distrustworthy. They're untrustworthy. Distrustful? Whatever. And so conservatives have a very negative view of human nature. And these conservative thinkers come along in reaction to the French Revolution, and they try to conserve or protect traditional ideas and values from these liberal attacks. Now, it is worth bearing in mind, conservatism is a progressive ideology. It is an ideology based on change. But whereas liberalism wants to see radical change and extreme change at this point, conservatism is about change to conserve. Have a little bit of change to prevent bigger changes. So they would say, give some laws, give some concessions to stop a revolution breaking out, but don't give everything away. Keep the best bits of the old system. So it is a reforming movement. What else does it have? Well, it's built on the idea of respect for authority and for tradition, that far from natural laws, you should look at the past and you should see what the best bits were, the best bits of monarchy, the best bits of authority, clear social structures so that everybody knows their place and everyone knows how they should link to each other. And these, in a conservative view, have developed over time, and those traditions are a way of keeping order and keeping stability to keep everyone safe and protected. Far from the sort of huge national communities, they see, and really removed from individualism, they think society is best structured around small communities. Small communities working together, normally with a clear leader and everyone has clear roles. They see the family as foundational, a small community with clear structures where everyone knows their place, everyone knows their role and the duty. The father as the provider who goes off to work, the mother who runs the home, and the children who know their place and know what they should contribute. They see small clubs or small platoons, as they sometimes get called, of people working together in their common interest, but with clear rules and clear societies. So conservatives will promote some liberal values like a constitution, but not so much as a way of limiting the government, but as a way of establishing the clear rules and procedures necessary to keep society stable. Now, conservatism also sees a distrust of completely free capitalism. So conservatives, they see capitalism, and of course, you can win big and lose big in capitalism. You see these violent swings between wealth and poverty as markets go up and down, as businesses change and evolve over time. And while they like the idea of private business as a means of protecting protecting yourself and protecting social bases, they see completely unregulated capitalism as too radical. It leads to instability because you have the big peaks and you have the big troughs. So they look to try and protect society from extreme free capitalism. They look to regulate capitalism, to have private enterprise, but to temper it with the use of tariffs and protectionist policies. This is one of the justifications the British have for developing their new empire. It's a way of imposing tariffs and preventing from the complete swings that you get with free market capitalism. Equally, and I should have mentioned this earlier, while liberalism views individual ownership of property as a means of protecting your freedom, making yourself independent from other people, not relying on charity, not relying on government support, conservatives will also look to promote property and property ownership, but often as a means of protecting your status. So they look at inheritance laws and the way of passing on wealth and positions of power in great houses and estates as a means of keeping society nice and stable. All of this is built on the idea of the negative view of humanity. And this is why Thomas Hobbes, although he has liberal ideas, is classed as a conservative thinker, because he's writing in the aftermath of the English Civil War and he's seen the worst excesses of people. And he says, this is terrible. This is just an awful, awful way of doing things. The people cannot be trusted. So whereas the liberals would say, yes, you can trust the people, democracy will work, we'll end up with some sort of fantastic society in the future, conservatives say, no, you've got to keep them in position, you've got to keep them in order, otherwise you end up with things like the English Civil War and the terror in France. So there is a need for law and order in all areas, in terms of social respect, which would include religion and a big promotion of traditional religious values, as well as in policing and authority and control over the people, that the people have to themselves be limited because they can't be trusted if they're left to their own devices. So we got the conservative reaction in the UK with the Conservative Party emerging, trying to temper the in the 19th century, some of the biggest excesses of liberalism in England, with social control, eventually the development of the police force. You see it with Catholic emancipation. It's a little reform to stop a bigger revolution, but no wholesale religious reform for many years to come. We see it in France, first with Napoleon establishing authority and control over France, and then the restoration of the monarchy. And we see it in Russia. where their response to what's been going on in Europe is to go to an even more radical form of autocracy. And to, after the 1905 revolution in Russia, which promised liberal reforms about education and personal freedoms, they go right back to autocracy and say, no. We've had these little changes, but we keep with religious dominance, we keep with political authority and respect for monarchs and traditional ways of doing things. Now, those were the two main rivals, and you had eventually in England the Conservative Party versus the Liberal Party, along these conservative and liberal ideas. However, as industrialisation took on, and as Britain led the way in becoming a developed nation, it saw a huge rise in poverty, and this created issues for both ideologies. Capitalism was seen to have been failing. We had huge amounts of poverty, and people were asking, well, why is this? Why have we got so much poverty going on? Liberals thought, well, it's because of the social restrictions and the laws that are put in, it's the tariffs that's stopping the economy growing. And so their answer was, what you need is greater freedom and education. But even then, as there were reforms in education, schooling was introduced gradually for most people, greater incentives to travel. Even those didn't answer the problems. But they kept coming up saying, well, it's not working. What we need is even greater freedom, more votes for more people, etc. This will provide for a more stable and peaceful society. The conservative wing, on the other hand, they say, well, no, all this poverty is just a lack of morality. And what we need is more preaching and more religion and to force people into getting themselves out of poverty. And if they're in poverty, it's their own fault. They're all alcoholic. The trouble is, even though they did introduce many really tough reforms to do with the workhouse, religious preaching and so on, it didn't work. And so they said, well, the answer is to have really tough prison sentences, to have stronger law and order, to just remove the bad elements because they're just naturally bad, and that will free up the rest of society. People are poor because it's a choice. They're lazy, they can't be trusted, and we need to punish them and deal with them. Liberals say, no, it's society that's making them criminal or putting them in poverty. Therefore, we need to give them a freedom, a rehabilitation, an educational way out of this. Neither of those is really working, and both of them were seen as kind of top-down movements, people telling those living in poverty what to do, and it certainly wasn't working. End result, we see the rise of socialism. And this is basically a reaction to the failures of liberalism and the failures of conservatism. They see the rise of poverty and the growing economic inequality, and Karl Marx and Friedrich Engels start this movement saying, no, capitalism is wrong. It leads to inequality in society. And we basically need to sweep all this away and provide an equal society where there is no hierarchy, there is no social mobility, because there's no need to move up and down social ladders, that everyone should be getting the same and treated equally. Scrap capitalism, scrap traditional hierarchy and authority, and basically allow everyone to be happy. There's elements of liberalism and elements of conservatism in here. But also it's far more radical as an ideology. So it sees capitalism in both its protectionist form of conservatism and its completely free form of liberalism as the root cause, and therefore socialists see the removal of capitalism as the big goal. Now, conservatism had its own reaction to this under Disraeli. It saw the rise of socialism and social opposition, and Disraeli saw it himself, that there was growing income inequality, and this was a serious threat to economic and social stability and problems with law and order. And this is where he develops the idea of one nation conservatism, that instead of having the two nations of rich and poor, which would allow socialism to grow, which might overthrow the whole of society, he argues that conservatives need to bridge the gap and create just one nation of people, where people can go from being rich to poor and vice versa, and a society that works for each other and together. Yes, with social mobility, yes, with strong hierarchy and authority, but one that would stop the advances of socialism. So that's where we get the development of this one nation conservatism that starts to see a bit more of a social conscience coming in, a bit more of a means of helping the poor, providing a safety net. Now, socialism was seen as quite a radical move, and it was slowly taking part in the radical areas. Again, the conservatives and the liberals introducing vote electoral reform was seen as a means of tamping down these effects and hoping to end the rise of socialism. But you also saw within the socialist movement people who said, hang on, having a revolution isn't the best way. The sort of Marx, Engels, even your Lenin, Rosa Luxemburg ideas of having a revolution, completely sweep everything away and start again. They saw that as being a problem. So in the UK, you get the growth of social democrats like Beatrice Webb, who want to promote evolution rather than revolution. She says, look, I don't want these. Actually, I say social democrats, more democratic socialists. But she doesn't want to keep capitalism. She wants capitalism to be gone, but she thinks the best way of achieving this is by working within the current system to alleviate the experiences of the poor, to eventually, when socialism arrives, it will be in everyone's interest. But you don't need to have a revolution. The people aren't ready for it. So this tempers some of the extreme revolutionary ideas, and it enables the trade union movement to grow and the Labour Party, which eventually becomes more acceptable to most people. And we see that coming through after World War One, where World War One was seen as a huge failure. It was seen as a capitalist war by many, that it was the wealthy got rich and the generals didn't know what they were doing, and it was ordinary working class people who died in the trenches and suffered as a result. So that saw the growth and establishment of the Labour Party, the Socialist Labour Party, as the second party in England, the sort of main rival to the Conservative Party, and the Liberal Party being eclipsed. Now, this rise of democratic socialism that saw the Liberals pushed out in England saw its own reaction, because clearly free market liberalism hadn't worked. It had led to the growth of socialism and eclipsed the traditional liberals. And so liberal thinkers came up with a new ideology, new liberalism, which would basically temper individual freedoms by the use of laws to ensure greater equality of outcome, ensuring certain protections and welfare benefits, like state pensions, to allow people individual freedoms to go and achieve their own goals. So new liberalism emerges as a reaction to socialism and the failures or perceived failures of traditional liberalism. So that's why that starts to emerge in the 1920s, 30s and on after World War II. Obviously, socialism kind of comes to fruition, certainly in the most extreme form, in communist Russia, although there's debate how far you call it socialist, but that socialist totalitarian state emerges. And of course, in the 1930s, following the complete failure of capitalism and the Great Depression and the failure of the tariff policies of America, which that degree of conservative protectionism, we get the popularity of socialism. Yes, the USSR becomes a beacon, but don't forget the fascist parties, the Nazis are so-called because they were the National Socialist Party. There's a lot of socialist thinking in fascist Italy as well. So we see the growth of these totalitarian socialist regimes, which end up eventually going to World War II. And even after World War II, the establishment of more communist states was seen to show the very worst elements of socialism, that it saw the removal of all individuality, of all individual freedoms, and everyone had to submit their will to the power of the state. As a result of this, not just communists, but the Nazis as well, and various fascist movements, we see a neoliberal reaction. People like Hayek, who lived in Austria and saw the socialists, the National Socialists, the Nazis there at first hand, and Ayn Rand, who escaped herself from communist Russia, and they become really critical of this totalitarian regime that removes all sense of the individual. And they end up creating neoliberalism, a sort of new form of liberalism that will go to extreme individual capitalism and promote the individual above all else, and actually be associated with the libertarian movement that government is the problem and you should have the smallest possible government going. All of this very much a reaction to the failures of big government and popularity of new right thinking that comes through. Now, Hayek and Rand, they are classed as conservative thinkers because they're also big on authority and on control. And although Rand was much in favour of atomism, individuals bumping around doing their own good, the greatest good for the greatest number, greatest good for yourself, her economic ideas get very much adapted by the New Right. And we get the New Right conservative movement, which is very similar to the neoliberals, this idea of reducing the role of the government in welfare as well as economic interference. And that's why it gets associated with the right, removing those ideas, removing the role of government and allowing individuals to think, do their own thing. It is very much a liberal ideology, but it's associated with sort of going back to the past, going back to sort of the 19th or 18th century when there were greater freedom. So there's sort of a conservative element to it. It's worth bearing in mind that Ayn Rand, although classed as a conservative thinker and a darling of the conservative right, she herself would not have called herself a conservative. She would have always called herself a liberal. And yet she wanted to reduce the government down and reduce the number of laws on people. Although she did believe there was a role of state for national power and for national defence. So these ideas start to take hold in reaction to the growth of government in America and Britain that had taken place since World War II, the sort of New Deal and the Great Society programmes in America that had seen government get more involved in people's lives, but at the same time seeing greater restrictions in individual freedoms and liberties. And when that broke down during the 1970s, they said, well, this is clearly not working because there's too many rules and regulations. Get rid of all those. We'll see a stronger, more stable economy and a happier society. The same happens in the UK. The growth of the welfare state under Labour in the 1940s, the promotion of it with the Conservatives and the sort of era of consensus politics coming through, falls apart in the 1970s when British economics becomes stilted, the government plays too big a role in deciding pay and wages and prices. Britain's basically making cars that nobody wants just to keep people employed, and it's seen as ridiculous. And so new right thinkers start to come through, challenging the power of the trade union movement, challenging government control over industries like the car industry. And we see that adopted very much by Margaret Thatcher and the New Right thinking. Economically, it's actually neoliberal and very left-wing, but it's associated with a traditional conservative agenda. Now, all of these wonderful ideas come through, and while they do reform what's going on in society, and economically, Britain and America seem to leap forward in the 80s under New Right thinking, it also leads to a lot of social discontent and social opposition. And there is unhappiness with this, sort of the nasty parties and evil people are the terms that are used. But these ideas seem to be a rejection of traditional socialism. The popularity of Thatcher's privatisation programmes by the people, the freeing up of the markets, deregulation, all of that, it becomes massively popular. And initially in Britain, and to a degree in America, the reaction of the left is to go further to the left. And they just get hammered electorally. This leads to the promotion of third way socialism, or if you like, socialism with a human face, or based on some principles, not socialism at all. People like Anthony Giddens and the Clintons in America, they developed this third way program. It's kind of capitalism with a human face, or it's basically tempering the socialist ideas of the left, reducing the role of government. And in many ways, it seems very similar to One Nation conservatism, much more of a traditional way. They're viewing capitalism actually not as a bad thing. This is what marks the third way as very different from other forms of socialism. All other forms saw capitalism as something that would need to be removed, either immediately or eventually. Third ways actually sees capitalism as potentially a force for good, something that can end poverty and create equality for all. So it is very distinct from other forms of socialism, and that's why New Labour quite often got called Blue Labour. Tony Blair was accused of being a closet conservatism, closet conservative, because actually most of the principles of third wave socialism are very closely aligned to sort of one nation or traditional conservative values. And, well, as we have now, we've seen a reaction to that, certainly in the UK, with Jeremy Corbyn and a more traditional form of socialism gaining in popularity. I hope that's made sense and gives you some idea of the sweep of ideological developments along the three core ideologies. It's from these ideologies that all the others, feminism, nationalism, multiculturalism, ecologism, they all emanate out from this to varying degrees. So if you've got an understanding of how these have developed and their reactions to real-world problems, it should give you a flavour of the main divisions within these key movements and how they relate to other movements. Anyway, I hope that's made sense. I hope that's been useful, and I will speak to you again at some point in the future. Thanks for listening. Goodbye.